providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Joe Mazumdar focusing a bit more on the resource equities. In these final two segments, we're chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. We're going to be talking gold and silver, more of the broader markets. CPM Group just released their gold yearbook, which I recommend you all check out. A lot of information within that over 200-page report focused on the gold market. Jeff, let's start off with a consistent driver behind gold demand. That's been the demand out of the East. China, as well as a number of other countries, have continued to build their gold reserves. We talked about this actually a few months ago, where this is, I believe, a 10-year trend that we've seen some higher demand from the East. How do you see this playing out? What's some of the more up-to-date data that you have?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, and it's actually been going on since about 2008 or so, and it's varied from country to country. Our data now for the full year of 2023 was net central bank buying of about 14 million ounces, and of that, you know, if you disaggregated it, about 18 million ounces gross purchases, of which 7 million ounces were the People's Bank of China. Yeah. So the People's Bank of China has been buying consistently now since November of 2022. They've been absorbing a lot of the gold that had built up in market inventories within China. And they've probably absorbed most of it now, so that you've got a Chinese market that is more tighter, more balanced. And I think that's being reflected in an increase in Shanghai premia over the London market. India, you know, and China's been adding gold reserves to gold to its monetary reserves since 2009. India had earlier been a seller, but they started reversing around the same time, and they bought some gold, and then they walked away, and then they come back and buying. You know, basically what you've got is India and China, first off, proclivity toward gold. But if you look at Greater Asia, these are countries that have a proclivity toward gold as an investment and as a form of savings and a monetary reserve. And they're also countries that don't have a lot of gold reserves in their central bank holdings, partly because they weren't major trading partner countries during the Bretton Woods system. You know, if you look at like Germany, which has close to 100 million ounces of gold in its reserves, all of that gold was built up between 1950 and 1971 by virtue of the fact that people were buying German goods and paying for them with dollars. And then the Bundesbank would take those dollars and buy gold from the U.S. Treasury at $35 an ounce. After the Bretton Woods system ended, they stopped buying gold. But all that gold was built up during the Bretton Woods dollar gold standard, when gold was used for international trade and capital flow settlements. India, China, a lot of Southeast Asia, East Asia were not major trading countries back then. They became major trading countries starting in the 80s and 90s, and they collected a lot of dollars. So whereas Germany, the United States, France, the UK, Italy had maybe 80 to 95% of their monetary reserves in gold, these countries had 80 to 95% of their reserves in dollars. And what you've seen since 2008 is a lot of central banks saying, we need to diversify away from dollars. It's not that we want to dump dollars, but we shouldn't have 80 to 95% of our reserves in dollars. So let us buy some gold, let us buy some euros, let us buy some other currencies. Some countries will try to match their currency foreign exchange reserves to their trade flows. So, you know, depending on how much they're buying and importing from various countries, they'll try to have that percentage of their foreign exchange reserves in that country's currencies. So you've seen this diversification that's been going on now for about 16 years. And it's likely to continue going on for decades to come. So it spells good. It's good for gold and gold price expectations because it's pretty much a consistent demand. Obviously, if you look at China, they were big buyers through June of 2019. When the price went over 1350, they stopped buying because they didn't want to chase the price higher. When the price came down back to 1640 in November of 2022, they started buying again. So you can expect some price sensitivity. You can expect some cyclicality. But over the long run, you should expect a lot of these central banks to be consistent long-term buyers of gold for addition to their monetary reserves.
Yeah, Jeff, it's been interesting to watch the Asian buyers be very savvy in buying when there's pullbacks in the price, but also to your point, many central banks just diversifying out of their currencies and putting a portion of it into gold along with other foreign currency exchange just to diversify their asset base. But on the retail investor side or the institutional investor side, I'd love to get your thoughts on what patterns you're seeing, because the pattern has been in the ETFs outflows. And you had made the point on our show a few times, that's because people were really shifting more to holding the physical metal. But even recently, we've seen some inflows into the ETFs. So what's your outlook on the retail and institutional investors?
Yeah, it's interesting because I believe through January, you were still looking at pretty hefty outflows from ETFs. Just looking at January, at the end of February, you had had 3 million ounces of net withdrawals or redemptions in gold ETFs, and that's reversed in March. It's a kind of an interesting phenomenon because if you look at other markets like India is looking at record high gold prices and weak rupee, so they've pulled back in March from buying as much. Chinese demand may have softened a little bit. Some of the institutional investors that we know of in the United States and high net worth individuals pulled back. You've seen some softening in March in investment demand from various sectors, but others have poured into the ETFs this month. And I think what that reflects is investors who were not necessarily active gold investors, but saw the gold price rising, and it's like, how do I buy gold? Well, the ETF is the easiest thing to do. So I think that that's what you're seeing with the inflows in March, is investors saying, I want to get on this gravy train. Gold is making record prices in March. Let me buy some ETFs. It'll be interesting to see if that continues, or if some of those guys then convert, liquidate their ETFs and buy physical metal to hold it on a different basis, which is really the trend that we saw over the last 3 years plus. Since 2021, we've seen investors selling their ETFs, about 6 million ounces of sales last year. Overall, investors were buying about 24, 25 million ounces of gold last year, but ETF holders were actually reducing their gold holdings about 6 million ounces. And, that was, to us, that reflected concerns over the financial market and financial industry stability, that you had investors saying, I do want to have exposure to gold, but I don't want to have counterparty risk that I have with ETFs, because these things are, at the end of the day, equities that are managed and administered by financial institutions. And that's been a trend over the last couple of years. It'll be interesting to see if that resumes if the price plateaus.
Hey, we've even seen an increase in some of the GDX and GDXJ volumes too, which does, at least to me, show a little bit more interest in the sector. What about the COT reports, the commitment of trader reports? What have you noticed within those reports that show renewed interest by certain investors? Give us a breakdown of what you've been seeing in those, please.
I haven't really been looking too closely at the COTs, but what we've seen is relatively steady demand in the futures and options markets. You've seen the gross short positions of institutional investors have declined from around 15 million ounces down to about 5 million ounces or 8 million ounces. So there's been a reduction of the number of institutions that were willing to play gold on the short side. compared to where they were, say, a year ago. And then you've seen a little bit of a pickup, maybe 20% pickup in the gross short, gross long position too. So there's some repositioning on the part of institutional investors in the futures and options market, where they're showing greater bullishness or greater expectations of really short-term gold price moves.
Jeff, when you look forward at, you know, forecasting, you're always very pragmatic and look at the supply-demand picture and look at price trends, look at the annual average. Do you have any idea of where gold could be heading, let's say, over the next 12 to 18 months? Because we hear a lot of wild projections out there that it's now breaking out, but I'd love to get your thoughts on forward-looking, how you see the price moving in gold.
Yeah, we've been bullish on gold. We expect the gold price to set new record levels this year. We have been saying that we thought that the gold price would rise to record levels in 2024 and probably again in 2025. And on an annual average basis, the annual average price has been a new record for the last 4 years. So we think that's going to continue for the next 2 years. What surprised us is that we thought that the demand for gold would be a little weaker now in the first quarter than it has been. We've seen very strong demand for gold at times, and we've seen the gold price, you know, push to new records, like I said, twice in the course of March to date. That tells us that investors are very much concerned about future economic developments and political developments. Our expectation is that the gold price may cool off a little bit in the second quarter. There's some seasonality there. And also, we are seeing some price hesitancy to buy at record prices. So, you know, we might see prices plateau, but they're plateauing at a much higher level than we thought. And our expectation now is that the gold price will indeed set new records, and that the gold price will be much stronger in the last 4 months of this year into 2025 than they are now. So we're looking for record prices. Now, when we say record prices, we're not talking about $30,000 gold or $10,000 gold. But, you know, if you look at the gold price on an annual average basis, last year was a very strong record, and the average price was $1,953. This year, the price is probably going to be at least 10% higher than that on an annual average basis. Now, if that means that the gold price averages, say, you know, something north of $2,050, so up $100 or more on an annual average basis, the intraday price will be that much higher. And I could easily see $2,400 or even $2,500 an ounce gold over the next 12 months on an intraday basis. But remember, those intraday spikes, they last for like 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and then the price comes down. So we're looking for higher prices. We think that the world is going to be more treacherous 12 months than it is from now than it is today, or especially 9 months from today. And we think that investors, you know, we're looking at the economy, they'll see a weaker economy by then. They may see more concerns about a recession in late 2024 or 2025. There's going to be a lot of political issues, not just in the United States, but around the world and internationally. And we think that the combination of all of those factors are going to cause investors to pick up their gold purchases. And if they bought like 24, 25 million ounces last year, you know, they might buy 28 million ounces this year. So we're looking at strong gold market this year and next year, and it's based partly on the supply-demand and investment demand trends, central bank demand, but it's also based on our economic and political outlook.
So, Jeff, how does this all carry down to the gold stocks then? I know you talk to a lot of the larger gold mining companies, and broadly, the larger gold mining companies seem to be more interested in combining with other larger gold miners and shedding non-core assets. Does this higher gold price environment change any of their strategies? And how do investors look at the gold stocks in your eyes?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a gold stock analyst per se. We analyze the gold stocks because we need to know, we need to have a view, our own view as to what future production is going to be from these companies. I think that the higher gold prices will, A, attract more capital to these companies and will make them more desperate to find mergers and acquisitions, because that's what they've tended to do in the past. And you may well see some greater dividends being laid off, because some of these guys have pretty good profitability, even on an all-in sustaining cost basis. The question in our mind is how much of the money will be spent on exploration and pre-development work as opposed to mergers and acquisitions. And our view is that the focus will be on mergers and acquisitions at the expense of exploration and pre-development, which is sad, because that exploration and pre-development really needs capital to fund future production.
Well, we'll keep eyes peeled out for more M&A. It does get the animal spirits going in the gold stocks, though. Jeff, we should also probably talk about silver. A lot of interest still in what's happening with the silver price. It has been a little peppier lately. What is your outlook on silver?
Well, silver continues to lag gold, and I think that that reflects some investor reluctance to get into silver. There's some investors who have been disappointed that the silver price didn't do what promoters had said it would do. Our expectation is that the silver price will do well. It's probably going to trade between, say, $22 on the low end and $28 on the high end for most of this year. I wouldn't be surprised to see the price testing $28 by the end of this year. Part of that's going to have to do with what happens politically within the United States and internationally in Ukraine and Europe and the Middle East.
So, Jeff, in terms of what's driving silver recently, everyone always wonders, is it the industrial demand? Is it the precious metals demand? What could provide that boost to get silver out of this kind of longer-term downtrend? Is it one or the other in your eyes?
It's got to be investment demand. I mean, fabrication demand provides a solid base for silver. But, you know, I don't think that fabrication demand has a profile that's going to be such strong increase that it will drive the price higher. One of the things that we've seen last year and continuing in this year is really much weaker investment demand. And it's going to take a turn, a reversal of that trend in investment demand to drive the price higher. And one of the things is, you know, the silver market is tight enough that if you saw like a 20 or 30 million ounce increase in net investment demand this year from what we're projecting, that probably is the difference between $22 and $28.
Well, Jeff, if the net investment demand is really what drives the silver price around the periphery, how much weight do you give the manufacturing side of the business? Because to Corey's point, we always hear it's a hybrid metal, and we always hear about its use in solar and in medical, and there's a lot of uses in electricity and in even some of the new EVs, but it doesn't seem like that's what really moves the price. It really seems, to your point, that it's really the investment demand on the edges that's moving it. How much weight do you give the industrial part of the silver story?
Oh, we pay a lot of attention to the industrial side and to gathering intelligence so that we can estimate how much silver is being used in each of those industries. And, you know, solar has been the big growth story for the last 10 or 15 years, and it's probably going to continue to be the big growth story. But, you know, it's not as big as the promoters let you have it. There is a price sensitivity across fabrication demand. So, you know, if you look at the price the relationship between prices and fabrication demand, it's a negative correlation. Higher prices, fabricators will try to reduce their per unit silver use. And they can do that. And they can substitute other commodities or other metals for silver in some applications. Although, you know, silver is the substitution for palladium and gold and various electronic applications. But, you know, it's very important to understand that fabrication demand, because that's taking silver out of the market. But the price is negatively correlated to fabrication demand. The strongest growth in fabrication demand tends to come when the silver price is low or falling. You know, and if you look at then the correlation between investment demand and prices, that's positively correlated in that investors will chase the price higher. When the price falls, investors get disillusioned and they sell, which is one of the things that we saw last year. A lot of disillusioned investors selling their silver, in some cases buying gold instead, in some cases just walking away from the precious metals environment. And that's what kept the price lower. But the investment demand is positively correlated to price. As investors buy silver, they'll drive the price higher. As the price rises, other investors will say, oh, the price is rising, I got to be back in silver, and they'll buy it. So investors will chase the price higher, while fabricators will wait for lower prices to buy more silver. You know, fabricators aren't going to say, oh, the price of silver is down, so I'll use more metal, or the price of silver is high, so I'll use more metal. You know, they're going to say the price of silver is high. This is a raw material in my product. What can I do to lower the raw material costs of making my product?
All right, Jeff, I want to ask you more big picture about the environment that we are in the financial front. We have gold at all-time highs, U.S. markets broadly at all-time highs, and even the dollar, yes, it's off its highs from a couple years ago, but right around that 104 level, we would have to go the whole way back to about 2002 when the dollar was hanging out more above just that 100 on the dollar index. So we can even say that the dollar is still broadly in historical nature strong too. What is this environment that the markets are living through right now?
I think one of the key things to pay attention to is investor concerns and central bank concerns about financial industry stability. You know, it's very interesting because, yeah, you have a relatively good economic environment. You have inflation coming down. You have interest rates plateauing. They haven't been rising. They haven't been falling, but they haven't been rising. And you have relatively good economic activity and a strong stock market. And investors and financial market regulators are looking at the world and saying, okay, this is probably the best that we can expect, and the economy weakens from here, and we have certain inflationary risks that we have to watch out for, and we have recessionary risks that we have to watch out for. So this may be the best economic environment. And in that environment, you're seeing investors buy a tremendous amount of U.S. treasuries. They need U.S. dollars to do that. So the dollar's strong, the treasuries are strong, and gold is strong. Investors are buying a lot, you know, 24, 25 million ounces of gold at record prices in a strong economic environment. That tells you that when the economic environment gets worse, they're probably going to buy even more gold, and the price of gold will go even higher. But the thing that gold promoters get wrong is they focus on the treasury, and they keep talking about the treasury market's going to drop and no one's buying treasuries. In fact, the amount of treasuries held by investors are at record levels, and the amount of treasuries held overseas by international investors are at record levels. You have more than $8 trillion in U.S. treasuries held in overseas accounts. And that's because the treasuries are relatively lower risk than other sovereign debt, corporate debt, stocks, and everything else. So what you're seeing in the treasury market and in the debt and stock market, a lot of investors saying, okay, I've got very good profits built into my stock position and my bond position, but I'm very nervous about what comes next. And I'm also very nervous about my risk to financial intermediaries as my counterparties. So treasuries, you get rid of that. And so you've got this shift in the treasuries. You're seeing a similar thing in gold. Like I said, over the last 3 years, you've had investors buying 25, 26 million ounces of gold each year, physical gold, but you saw net sales of gold ETFs. And that's because those ETFs have financial intermediary counterparty risk. So what you're seeing are investors around the world saying, I'm worried about the future, and I'm worried about counterparty risk in a more hostile future economic environment. And that's why you're seeing investors buy gold and U.S. dollars and U.S. treasuries right now. They're looking at their counterparty risk and they're saying, I have to reduce that as much as possible ahead of the next financial crisis.
All right, Jeff, we're wrapping it up here. Thank you very much for your time. Very interesting comments on how you see gold moving here. It's quite a bullish outlook, and it makes sense as long as it kind of plays out as you have said, this maybe looking further out to the end of this year, early next year, is some more economic issues rearing their head. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Be sure to check out our website, kereport.com, and podcast, the KE Report, for all our daily editorials and company updates. Jeff, again, thank you for your time. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.